To those of you listening during or around the same time this episode is launched, I hope you're all safe and that your loved ones are too. Without a doubt, this coronavirus is absolutely insane, but please, please, please remember, this too will pass. If you want my full take on how we should all look at this chaotic moment as an opportunity to become more adaptable, please be sure to watch my most recent video post on Instagram. It's a friendly and, yes, challenging reminder that how we choose to respond to this is in our own hands, and I think that's really critical for everybody to remember. We can't change what happens. We can change our response. We can control our response. And we owe it to everybody we serve and everyone we love to take this time to adapt and become better. I know it's enticing to think of all the things you're not able to do right now, all the ways your life may be inconvenienced, but there's so many opportunities for growth in this, and I don't want any of you to miss that. I really, really don't. And we're doubling down at Art of Coaching to make sure we do our part to help you through this transition. We'll talk about how in a moment. So this sense of responsibility is something that myself and today's guest have in common. Specifically with what we're doing at Art of Coaching, I believe we owe it to everyone we lead to double and triple down on becoming better communicators. How? Well, through understanding more about the human element of what we do, which is why we have now opened both of our flagship online courses, bought in and valued, and made them accessible to you year-round. Previously, these only opened twice a year. We did very limited launches, but now if you go to artofcoaching.com, you can find these available to you year-round. Just go to online courses, could not be more easy to find. You can also email info@artofcoaching.com. And guys, like anything, these apply to any vocation. So if you are a strength coach and you're dealing with parents, kids, colleagues, coworkers, whatever, colleagues and coworkers are the same, it applies. But if you're a doctor or nurse, business owner, just understand that I can only use so many nouns, right? So it could be clients, it could be students, it could be this. Just like you read any book, these things apply. The important thing is that it's available year-round. Now, guys, these are the only courses of their kind that offer immersive learning on how to become a better coach. Not only that, it also covers how to avoid burnout, how to become a better professional, how you can deal with different forms of conflict like this. I mean, right now we have coaches like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to be able to coach people. I have to move online. How am I going to do this? We cover all that in Valued. We talk about how to future-proof what you do, your career, all these things. In Bought In, we talk about how to adapt your communication style. So whether you're live in person, whether you got to communicate online, whether you have to do it in different electronic formats, how you can optimize that. Again, you owe it to them. This isn't really about you, me, or us collectively. It's about like what you owe to them, because don't forget the people you serve are really inconvenienced here too. And so we've got to get better at these things, and no other resource covers this. We're really tripling down on it. We know we're not perfect, but we do have our heart in the right place, and we think that we offer a compelling solution to help you guys become better communicators. Similarly, my guest today, Matt Wan, and his company, Momentous, has accepted the responsibility of creating what I believe to be the purest and most transparent supplements available in the market today. Tried, tested, and transparent, Momentous is leading the way with respect to NF certified for sport supplementation and other forms of performance enhancement that are ethical, that are clean, and most importantly, are accessible to people of any vocation. Whether you're the traveling business person, whether you're in the tactical space, or whether you're the athletes, these are forms of nutritional insurance that you can utilize. And what makes Matt special, in my opinion, is that he's spearheaded this through a relentless obsession to help others become the best version of themselves. Now, this episode is going to document Matt's journey and Momentous's journey in doing so, and more specifically, how they've done so with great respect, patience, and a product that doesn't compromise during a time where I think everybody's just obsessed with cheaper is better. And I think that's causing a lot of issues. You have to understand some products are a premium product for a reason, because it warrants it. You can't have the best of all worlds. You can, but you're going to have to invest in that. So please listen in, learn, and if this episode helps you, please leave a review. Matt's journey is undeniably inspiring, and I hope you guys enjoy. Take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and we'll talk to you soon. On with the episode. Welcome to the Art of Coaching Podcast, a show aimed at getting to the core of what it takes to change attitudes, behaviors, and outcomes in the weight room, boardroom, classroom, and everywhere in between. I'm your host, Brett Bartholomew. I'm a performance coach, keynote speaker, and the author of the book Conscious Coaching. But most importantly, I'm a lifelong student interested in all aspects of human behavior and communication. I want to thank you for joining me, and now let's dive into today's episode. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Art of Coaching podcast. I'm here today with Matt Wan, founder of Momentus, who, if you guys have been listening to the podcast for a while now, you understand that Momentus is our partner. So, Matt, thanks for coming, and I appreciate you being on the show, man, and all your support.
Thank you, Brett. Yeah, thanks for the warm intro, and thanks for letting us be a part of it. It goes without saying what big fans we are.
Yeah, man, I appreciate that, and likewise, there's a lot of reasons to be a fan of your work as well, Matt. There's a reason I partnered with you guys, and I think we've had some people that are really curious about Momentus on, you know, not just the product side, but ultimately the story, the vision, and everything it took to get there. And you have a really unique background, man. I think, you know, like most people in your position, I know you'll kind of shroud it in a air of humility, but coming from somebody that has unique family background, being from Wyoming, dropping out of Harvard, which we're going to talk about, where did this journey start for you? And how did you manage kind of all the reasons why you shouldn't have maybe done what you've done in creating the larger brand of Momentus and the products in general?
Yeah, a lot of ground to cover there.
Yeah, well, we'll break it up for everybody. No worries.
Yeah, I think that maybe the idea of humility in this position is not necessarily so common, but I'll do my best to stay there for you. I was really introduced to the space, and the journey started, if you will, by just being an athlete, being a user of the products, and certainly not at the level that you're used to training and working with directly. But I was serious enough that I wanted every advantage I could get when it came to performing better. I was looking for foam rolling techniques, ice baths, compression socks, you know, e-stim, whatever it was that I thought the best athletes in the world were using or the smartest guys in the room were using, whatever it was, I wanted to find ways to increase my own performance. I was just a bit of a training nerd, if you will. And so there are quite a few, I guess, junctions in my life where I was fortunate to be exposed to some really interesting resources in performance training and nutrition in particular. But really, at the end of the day, what started us on this road in terms of the business was that I was fortunate enough to go inside an NFL locker room when I was pretty young, as you noted. And essentially what I noticed was that the products that I was used to seeing all over the sidelines were not the products that the athletes were using in the locker room. These were products that the trainers and dietitians on the team had been recommending, but that didn't necessarily have any sort of consumer penetration. They were certainly not products that I was used to seeing on Amazon or Whole Foods or GNC or Vitamin Shoppe, wherever you're getting these products. And so that really made us ask a bunch of questions, frankly, but most importantly, it made us ask why that is. Why do we have a huge group of what we feel generally are pretty educated consumers who are looking to do the best for their body and are generally buying premium in so many other categories of health and fitness, but are still gravitating towards, you know, whatever the guy at GNC recommends, whatever the cheapest product per gram of protein is on Amazon. That's just not how we buy anything else in health and fitness. It's certainly not how we buy anything else that we put in our bodies. So we think there's a real opportunity to create a brand that speaks to individuals who are looking to use products that the best in the world use.
And that, here's the thing, when you said that you guys look at things as they are and you think, all right, why? Why is it this way? Why is it that way? That's a little bit why, Matt, I tried to ask that in such a broad way, because here's one thing I've learned, and you didn't disappoint on this front. Sometimes when you look broadly, it really helps you kind of see more specifically and a more focused view the problems, the issues, or even the path. And so, for example, I've noticed when sometimes I ask people that question, they discuss their past experience, which leaves clues, right? Like you did, you were an athlete, and it doesn't matter at what level. The fact is you were an athlete that had an appreciation for a certain lifestyle and an affinity for performance. And then there's always this nexus, and you use the word junction, right? Like you had several junctions in your life that kind of led you down this path of curiosity. You said you were able to go into the locker room, right? That feeds the curiosity, creation, and later collaboration. And so hearing you having gone through some of those things, where, I mean, it's one thing to experience these things, Matt. It's another thing to say, you know what? I'm going to start a company. And you know what? It's going to be a premium price point. And you know what? I'm going to take on the big dogs in the field that have already gotten a strong foothold, sponsorships, affiliations, and endorsements. Matt, where the hell do you even start doing that?
Looking back on it, it's honestly hard to tell you, but as much as anything, I think you just start by asking questions. You start by asking why things are the way they are, I think, as you framed it. And to be honest with you, this is probably not a story that I've told in a lot of different ways, because it's not something that necessarily fits with how we talk about the brand now. But when we really started looking into the opportunity in this market and why are so many people going to a great gym, they've got a great personal trainer, they are eating well and still buying whatever the cheapest product is at Costco and Amazon. Why is the domination of low quality products still so prolific in this category? We looked at a whole bunch of reasons, right? And we can talk about what we ended up determining, but we looked at, you know, is it a convenience factor? You know, do we need to just offer a really great subscription model? Are the good products not being sold online? Are the good products not being sold in shelves? Are the products not packaged or branded the right way so that they appeal to people? We went through a whole bunch of different options to try to explain that.
Yeah, and the reason I'm curious about that in particular is, to me, I felt like this was similar to the podcast and some of the courses that I've created. Is I looked at coaches and I thought, all right, how come so many of the things coaches are discussing in many of the podcasts and other things that existed before these resources that I've tried to do with Art of Coaching, they're discussing things that very rarely are the true core of the problem, right? They're sitting there and it's not that they're not important at all, but it's kind of like they continually go deep down in one area instead of shining light in the dimly lit areas. And that's what fascinates me about human behavior. And so I'd like you to kind of expand on that. When you were looking at this and the reasons, was it access? Was it because they had affiliations with other companies or athletes? What was it that you thought kept people down this path of the same thing, the same thing, the same thing, even if it wasn't the highest quality or the most relevant to their goals or needs?
For us, I think it came down to education. And there are a number of ways to interpret the issue, I think, but we really believed that, like I said, there are a huge group of consumers who really already want the best product or the best methods, mindsets for themselves, whatever it is that's going to help them perform better and feel better. We believe that desire already exists. We don't believe there's a reliable outlet for it, meaning that you may have people who say, man, I really want to be strength training regularly because I've heard all these great things about it. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's a great outlet for them to go and find the right information or resources. We think the same thing is true in nutrition, that there's a huge desire to be using the right products and doing the right things. But where the heck do you start?
Right.
Where do you start when really at the end of the day, if you had to kind of summarize what it is we're fighting here, it's that how many times have you heard a guy at the gym say, All protein powder is the same. All pre-workouts the same. All multivitamins the same. Whatever it is that you're taking or recommending for your athletes, that is just not what the experts think. That is not how we treat, like I said, anything else that we put in our body. You know, you shouldn't just do squats to do squats, just like you shouldn't take protein just to take protein, right? All these things have a really specific purpose, and the details matter when you approach them.
Yeah,
it's really that simple. We need to be able to educate people not on why you need a great product. We really think that desire already exists, but what creates a great product? What do you need to look for in this category?
And You're right. It's that simple in regards to looking at, you know, education. I think the issue is, and what's interesting, and I'm just curious at how you guys continue to fight this, because I think that this is just kind of society where we're at now, combined with a little bit of human nature. But it's tricky, right? Because we assume that people will respond to a rational argument. Hey, yeah, all protein isn't the same, right? There's a distinction between proteins that have certain kinds of ingredients that are sourced responsibly, NSF certification, informed sport, all those kinds of things. But so many people, Matt, still make decisions with this kind of quick system one. Yeah, but this is right here. And yeah, I see this. I mean, at what level does that frustrate you as a founder and your team in terms of like, all right, we can't just rely on education and experts, because we know that there's still a lot of people that are going to poo-poo on that research or not acknowledge the expert. What other paths have you learned that you have to take? At what point is it just like, all right, try it for yourself and let me know what you think, or what did you try?
I'm actually going to disagree with you there, because I think that's part of what makes the opportunity for this business so exciting for us. I think that's what gets us up in the morning, is that people continue to choose the wrong products. It wouldn't be an opportunity if they were already buying great products. We think our opportunity is to give access to the experts. You may think, and frankly, Brett, you know, I think you and I are probably not the best opinions when it comes to how available resources are in this space. You know, you've got a really great set of resources when it comes to learning how to train better and eat better, right? I'm not quite on that level, but I feel like I've got a pretty good set of resources as well. The vast majority of people do not have access to the kind of experts that you do, that, you know, we now do by you know, the benefit of having you in our network as well. We really feel it's sort of part of our place and our opportunity to peel back the curtain on that, if you will, to make that level of information widely available and popular, make it digestible. And that's when I start to think about, you can't just make the rational argument. But there's two parts to it for me. I think on one hand, I actually don't think that the information, as you said, is necessarily widely available. I think for a small group of people it is, but part of our job is to make expert opinion, the methods, mindsets, products, whether they can be put it in a bottle or not, available to the public. And then the other part of that is trying to make something that is interesting to people, that you can lead a horse to water. You can give somebody the right information, right? You can even give somebody the right programming. But if they're not going to do it, they're not going to take it, they're not going to use it or implement it, then what difference does it make? That's when you have to start thinking past the idea of just a rational argument, right? Because, you know, like, let me give you an example. When we started making these products, I could not have cared less about what the products tasted like. Couldn't have cared less. Because when I grew up, my trainer at the time, Dave, gave me products that were, in his opinion, the highest quality on the market. I still think they're great products, but they tasted terrible. They were horrible. They always tasted terrible. And I didn't care, because I wasn't trying to have candy. I wasn't trying to have a treat after my workout. I was trying to get stronger. And that's the rational argument, right? That you are not taking this because it tastes good. You're taking it because you're trying to get stronger. Therefore, you should buy the best product by these measures. But to actually get people to take the best product, as it turns out, thank God we had smarter people on our team that were able to convince me of this, you had to put a ton of effort into the flavor, an enormous amount of effort into the flavor, because literally what happens with so many of our clients across all the major leagues when we're actually selling products to these teams is that the dietitians, the strength coaches, whatever sort of performance professional they have in house there, they get the product right away. They say, okay, here's why it's better. We understand that. I've got to try it with my athletes, because if they're not willing to use it, they don't like it, they don't want to use it every day, then it's useless to me.
Sure. Yeah. And I think our wires got crossed there, Matt. I'm actually, I was saying rational persuasion is often not the way to go, because that's what people make decisions emotionally, and then they tend to back them up with some element of either confirmation bias or past experience.
So, yeah, that's right. They find a rational reason to justify it, right?
Right. Like, oh, cool iPhone. Oh, you know what? That could really help with my emails and this and that. Let me pay $1,000 for it. And so that's actually what I wanted to target is, when you know that because people don't have access to true experts, but people do have access to what they perceive to be experts, people think it's very hard for an authentic message and a real product like yours and like to get to its core audience, because they've got to wade through all this other bullshit and people telling them, no, I'm the expert. No, look at me because I'm ripped and I take this, and look at me because I take that. And you touched on it a little bit with flavor. At some point we have to concede that, like, hey, even though, and I'm with you, I'll just crush something and what it tastes like is what it tastes like. I think I just, you know, certain things are a means to an end and you have to do what's right for your body. But unfortunately,
right. So that's the rational argument, right, for consuming the product, right? But to sort of clarify my point as well, we had to concede that there was more to it than the rationale,
yep,
right?
Yep.
Than just that rational side. We had to have the clear product benefits as well as presenting it in a format that was, you know, no pun intended, very digestible.
Yeah. And that's what's so fascinating about these things, I feel like, is no matter what, and when you create something, you're like, you know what, this should speak for itself. Look at kind of the state of union, so to speak. And it's like, ah, man, so much of it still comes down to understanding human nature and like the most base level of it and getting creative with your marketing and then letting the product speak for itself. And that brings me to the kind of collaboration element of it, Matt. Like, how did you go about, Steve Jobs said it wasn't hard to create, right, the iPhone and stuff like that. It was hard to create a really great team. How have you managed that, given, you know, your background, and I'm sure you had your own circumstances where people maybe thought, hey dude, like, who are you and what have you started and how old are you? How did you manage perception on that end as well?
I don't think making the product was necessarily easy. I think we were really fortunate to have, as you said, the right people behind us. I don't pretend to be the nutritional expert here, right? We've got people, thankfully, in-house who really know what to look for when it comes to these products, and not just the ingredients themselves, but how to source them, how to process them, even what we should be looking for in terms of third-party certifications, what sort of packaging they should be in. We were really fortunate to be able to bring in a really tremendous group of experts to, frankly, lead the product formulation processes for us. So that part was, I'd say, easier, but not the easiest, right? The more difficult part, I guess, to your point, was probably finding those individuals to begin with. And then the rest of the team is, woof, it's wide now, wide reaching. And I guess our approach there was, well, it's evolved, frankly. You know, let's start here, right? Like, the first person who I hired for this business was actually, he's still our operations director here. He's been phenomenal with us. I'm sure he'll be with us forever. Was at the time my high school track coach.
Your high school track coach?
Yes.
I love
yes.
it. Tell me this story.
Well, that was how I knew him. And he's obviously, as I said, been phenomenal, and we're just so lucky to have him on the team. Wouldn't be here without him. And it was just us for, you know, 6, 8, 9 months, almost a year, probably not quite. But I hired him because he was my best option. And he wouldn't take offense if I said this, but if I had $250,000 or $10 million to go spend, I could have just gone and hired some CEO if I had all the money in the world. But that's not what I wanted to do, right? What could I do? I needed to get somebody that I really trusted. I needed to get somebody that I knew I could work well with, that I was going to get along with. I needed to get somebody that I knew was going to work hard. Those were the requirements at the time, right? And as the company evolves, you grow into looking for more specific roles. Because at the time, how could I have possibly known what I was going to need? how would I have known what I was even going to need to be looking for in somebody who's going to need to manage partnerships? How would I have known what to look for in a sales director? There's no way I would have known. I was 18. All I knew at the time was there is going to be a whole lot of challenges ahead of us. So I need somebody, as I said, that I'm excited to work with and is going to show up every day. And so I picked a guy, I picked the guy that I was sort of most excited to work with every day.
Now we're getting to the good stuff. And this is kind of why I think, Matt, that it's so unique is you mentioned it, right? You were 18, you're trying to build a team, and right now you don't know what even who you need. And I think that, again, this was no idea. It was serendipitous because a year ago I found myself in the same position. And you know what? People do this all the time. I mean, like, it's funny. I argue that most professional teams, and I've worked with a good deal of them in some capacity or another, they don't even know what they're looking for. We live in a market of relative confusion because everybody's inundated with all these issues and information, and this person's the best fit. So when you say that this has evolved now, and what's this gentleman's name, by the way, your former high school track coach?
His name's also Matt, funny enough.
Perfect. So like once you got Matt on your team, like, can we just talk about that, the dynamics of it? And I promise I wouldn't ask you this if people couldn't relate to it, but you're 18. Now, granted, yeah, you already have rapport and some level of buy-in or trust with this individual. Talk to me about that moment where you're like, hey, I got this idea, we're doing this. And then after you had that first follower, where did it go from there and how has it evolved? Just because people need to know how to build teams, and you've done this. So talk us through this a little bit more if you would.
Honestly, it was, I think more than anything, we were bought into the idea of moving the chains as opposed to trying to throw Hail Marys, meaning that we were highly ignorant. We did not know what we were going to need a year later. We didn't know what we were going to need 6 months later. But we were enthusiastic and we moved forward with the idea that every day we were going to move closer to our goals, right? We're very rarely going to be faced with opportunities or even have the visibility towards huge opportunities in addressing our goals or moving the business forward. Those came later. Really what it was about was like just moving the chains every day, making progress, getting things done. I guess I've said it before, but I think really the single biggest difference between somebody that starts a company and somebody that's just got a great idea is the willingness to get off your ass.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. I think, and that was something I remember looking back at an article when I was first discovering you guys, and it was talking about how, you know, your company decided to come out of a self-described stealth mode. And you had mentioned that you had been selling products to professional and collegiate teams for a while now. I think it was about a year. And then you had started going to, you know, direct to consumer. And, you know, for you to make an announcement like that and come out of stealth mode and all that, like, there's real consequences. Like you said, if you don't get off your ass, like, curiosity is not enough. And I know people love to say passion, and that's all well and good. But the real shit is that there has to be consequences, right? Like, what were the consequences at this point of your life if Momentous didn't work and you hadn't got off your ass?
The consequences would have been, very wide ranging, frankly. We had taken money from professional investors. We'd taken money, you know, in the form of investment from friends, from people that we really respected, the people that placed a lot of trust in us. We placed a lot of trust in ourselves, and we'd taken a bet on ourselves that this was something that was going to be worthwhile for the community that we cared about and for ourselves. The consequences to not getting up were to disappoint all of those things, to do something that I guess I just wasn't willing to do, frankly, and that I really think if you're going to take somebody's money in particular, you can't half-ass it. You can't say, oh, but I had this going on in my life at the same time. Oh, it just wasn't a good time for me to be running a business. Oh, it wasn't a good time for me to be training hard. It wasn't a good time for me to do XYZ. there's never a good time. There's always a million reasons why you shouldn't be doing it. But at the end of the day, we were just not prepared to accept that consequence of you, if you will, of not giving it 110% effort. Yeah. I think starting a company, starting any sort of project, needs to have an acceptance of failure, an awareness that that is a possibility, still a possibility. Of course, it's still a possibility. It's always a possibility, but you can't not do everything you can to fight it. You know, that's just the mentality that we come at it with. When we're faced with challenges, I think our instinct in this company is not to shy away from them. It's to attack.
And when you attack, you mentioned it, right? Like the importance of having a pre-mortem. Again, it's great to have effort. It's excellent to have tremendous focus. It's incredible to have great vision. But finding that balance, that yin and yang, so to speak, between attacking, but being aware of that pre-mortem. And for anybody listening, just right, this is all the things that could go wrong and oh shit, what if this fails and how could it fail? Like, did that stuff keep you up at night? I mean, it had to. And even if it didn't, I mean, to a degree, does it now? Because I know ignorance is bliss to a degree, and not to assume like you're not ignorant, right? But just sometimes like you don't know what you don't know at the time you don't know it. Do you think that helped at all? Or had you guys just already gone through all that? Did you have somebody guiding you through this at this point?
I've got really, really great resources at the company. I think we all benefit from that. But to be honest with you, I was completely ignorant. And I actually think this is probably the one inherent advantage I had being a young entrepreneur, was that I was completely ignorant, meaning that I could not possibly have known ahead of time how challenging it would be, how stressful it would be, all the challenges that would come up, all the roadblocks. I couldn't have possibly known. And that may have been, in my opinion, I think one of my very few natural advantages, and that ignorance made for just a naturally greater appetite for risk. I truly didn't know what I didn't know. Right. I made this comment the other day to one of our investors, right, that when I started the company, I felt like I knew 1% of what I needed to be successful. Or I'm sorry, I had that backwards. When I started the company, I felt like I probably knew, you know, maybe 20 or 25%. Of what I needed to be successful.
Yeah.
So I was feeling like I was being modest, right? Okay, I've got a pretty good grasp on this. If I can learn how to address these key areas, then I think we're going to be on a good path. But as the circle of your knowledge grows, right, so too does the perimeter of your ignorance. So
yeah.
I did not know what I didn't know. And so now 3 years later, I know however many thousand times more than I did, you know, when I had no experience. And I feel like I know probably, you know, a fraction of 1% of what I need to.
Hey, everybody, we're going to get right back into this episode. I don't want you to miss any of this, but I did want to remind you that as part of the Art of Coaching audience, if you use the code BRETT20, again, that's my first name, BRETT20, BRETT20 at checkout at livemomentous.com. Anything they have there, you are going to get $20 off your first order. If you're not familiar with Momentous, just a reminder, Momentous is the premier sponsor of the Art of Coaching podcast. In short, they're the reason I'm able to bring this information to you guys for free. They help me cover the cost of the podcast and all the other content that I'm able to get to you guys. So, you know, their support is huge. Now, if you're not familiar with the products, they have a wide range, everything from their absolute zero grass-fed whey. And again, guys, this is all whey isolate, the purest form of whey, arc fire grass-fed whey. Not only that, they have a 100% plant protein for those of you that can't do whey. They have strength recovery, and they're always coming out with new and unique products. Now, one of the reasons I partnered with Momentous is I am a minimalist when it comes to any of this stuff. I'm a big believer that consistency in your training, sleep, hydration and just good nutrition are the most powerful supplements. But there are certain staples that we can't get around, and we have to be able to source in the most responsible way possible. And that we also have to just be able to add in through supplementary form, whether that's because we're at busy lifestyles, because we have digestion issues, any number of factors. And so, you know, protein and fish oil is really the only thing that I take. Every now and then I might experiment with some other stuff that's all natural, but I'm from the Midwest. So there's a running joke that we kind of grew up on steak and milk, but Momentous is absolutely something I am behind 100%. And again, if you just use the code BRETT20 at anything on livemomentous.com, or you can check out the Art of Coaching Momentous link on the show notes, you're going to be hooked up. Thanks again for your support. And now back to the episode. Well, I mean, that's a big reason, Matt, they say, right? Like, it's experience isn't something you get till just after you needed it. And I remember to touch on, and this relates to some excellent points you made. One of my favorite quotes was by a guy named David Grayson. And he said, you know, do you think you could have the good without the evil? Like, do you really think you could have the joy without the sorrow? And, you know, it's better in your circumstance, you said, you know, like, yeah, I had to be modest in some respects. And I always argue it's better to be modest than to engage in microwave thinking, because it's amazing to me how many people still think, oh yeah, I got an idea and I know one or two people and I figure I can raise money for it and we can go from there. And again, I just think we've been blinded by terms like passion and vision and whatever. And really there's competency, curiosity, and consequences that probably get us the majority of the way there. And they only get bigger as you guys grow, right? Because now here you are and the company is continuing to expand its role and its foothold. So do you, with your mention of risk, Matt, do you like, is the risk now greater than ever? Or do you feel like, no, now we've, of course the risk is there, but we've used it as a fuel source and now it's attack mode. It's our time.
I think it depends how you define risk. I feel like the wind is at our back. And I think that's always how we should look at it, that we have so many great opportunities in this market now. We have so many great products in the pipeline. Just came out with Sleep earlier in the fall, coming out with collagen really shortly here. Huge number of product partnerships that are coming out in 2020 as well. And even when you look past sort of the rational arguments for why I think the company is in a great position now, I just think that's always the perspective you should have, that, you know, you shouldn't worry about bad luck. You shouldn't worry about a change in the economy, a change in the market, these things you can't control. You know, the company is not going to succeed or fail because of those things. The company is going to succeed or fail because of the people involved, the decisions we make. And I think we've got the right team to do those things. So I don't think that this is the riskiest time for the business. I think it's clearly measurably the lowest risk time for the business. But at the same time, that doesn't mean we're not still setting the bar high.
Sure. And within that, you mentioned the product, right, coming out with Sleep, and we had mentioned that on a previous podcast, and you doing collagen, which that actually brings about my next question. Being selective is an important part, right? I heard you on a previous podcast, Matt, and you talked about, you know, find reasons to say no. For you, how did you determine and discern what you guys are going to create and what you firmly believe, at least at this juncture, you're going to say no to? We're not engaging in that.
So I think the analogy I was using there was that discipline for us is a willingness to say no to good opportunities, and that good opportunities, they come and go. So do bad ones. And so many of these things look good and look like something that you can't pass up, but there's going to be another train coming. And so we need to be really hyper-focused on creating the products and services that deliver value for our customers, right? For our core customers in particular, that meet and exceed the standards and create the greatest impact for us in supporting our mission and vision here. I think the analogy specifically I was using was that my dad's been an investor for a long time. And so that was really my sort of first introduction, I think, to business, was looking at companies from an investment perspective. And maybe he wouldn't like the way I characterize this necessarily, but he once described to me when he was looking through basically a company's deck, right? That he asked for my opinion, right, on it. And I said, well, here's all the things that I think are good about it. Here's where I think they could improve. And if they just worked on this thing, I think it'd be really successful. Like, oh, it's so close. What if they just fixed this? Oh, what if they just brought in a different leader in this position, whatever it is. And he sort of stopped me and said, when you're looking at these things, you don't need to look for a reason to say yes. You need to look for a reason to say no. Because if you're going to do this job, you're going to get 35 of these a day. You are going to see so many opportunities. And even if you're an entrepreneur, you're going to see so many opportunities every single day. You're going to feel like you see them everywhere. So you can't rely on finding a reason to justify doing a deal, making a move, signing something, whatever it is, right? Sometimes you need to be able to look at it from the lens of finding a reason that it won't work, right? So you can move on. That was what I was taught in that perspective. And frankly, I don't think that's relevant for every project. I think in some cases, particularly on the entrepreneurial side, you need to be able to move past the reasons that something might not work and accept risk. But on the flip side to that, it is a really valuable tool, I think, in assessing opportunities. And I think as well, it's valuable for us as we look at the variety of opportunities that face us, particularly when it comes to what sort of products and services can this company provide over time. That there are, I think, as you said, a ton of great different directions we can go, but we need to make sure that what we're doing is not just a good solution, but it's the right solution. To say that something makes sense on paper, to say there are all these reasons that you should do it, is not necessarily enough, because you've also got to think about, you know, you've also got to think about the opportunity cost. We have this discussion when it comes to creating new products all the time because, you know, the company's still small. We have relatively limited resources. And so sometimes to create one product means we need to wait on creating another.
Sure.
Or we need to push it down the road meaningfully, right? To hire one position means we can't hire another.
I'm trying to think about you. You totally took the piece that I was going to ask you next, but I want to give you,
sorry.
No, it's perfect. This is why we do unscripted podcasts, because I want to give you context of why I was going to ask it, but you gave me a great lead in. Opportunity cost is something that is hurting coaches in strength and conditioning and performance. And I'd say even fitness, but most in strength and conditioning and in the performance realm more than ever before, Matt, there's an issue where coaches are dealing with, you know, everything from burnout to low wages. I mean, data came out that showed coaches right now that have been in certain domains, have spent, you know, around 10 years in the field, are still averaging a little bit more only than $30,000 in the United States alone. We have all these issues. And what I try to tell people is you need to assess your opportunity cost. And this is a big reason why I price certain things the way that I do, whether I'm training athletes, whether I'm speaking or what have you, because, and I think most people don't consider that. And as somebody who has created not only a very unique, high quality product, but a premium priced one, what goal or what role did kind of just the knowledge of opportunity costs, both professionally and personally as it pertains to your health and everything like that, role? What did that play in terms of you guys determining who is our customer? And it's a premium customer. We're not trying to be for, you want to be for everybody, but ultimately, you know, it's not going to be like, just expand on the opportunity cost within that, because I don't think people consider that enough. I don't think they know how visceral and how real and how corrosive that can be if you ignore those things.
Yeah, it's a great point. The worst thing that we could do as a brand is try to make everyone happy. The worst thing you can do as any influential person, brand, organization is generally to try to make everybody happy, because it's clearly impossible. So we needed to focus on some of the obvious things, right? Which are, what are the most valuable customers for us? Where is our product going to resonate? Where is The educational resource is going to resonate. Where are we going to be able to make a footprint? Because I guess, as you said, we needed to be able to leave pennies on the table in order to make dollars. We needed to be able to say that we're okay if this product doesn't appeal to everyone. We're okay if this product or this brand doesn't do it for some customers, doesn't convince them to leave their gold standard or CelluCore or whatever it is they're using from GNC. We're okay with that because at the end of the day, our goal is not to own 100% of the market. That's not what we're trying to achieve here. It's not what any brand's trying to achieve here. It's not realistic. We're trying to create a brand and a product that appeals to the right set of people. And for us, those are people that, as I've said before here, already have the desire to buy the best products, to do the best for themselves, to eat the best, to train the best, to be the best version of themselves. We couldn't feign to think of the company spending resources convincing people that they need to do those things.
And it shouldn't really take, at the end of the day, a whole lot of convincing, right? Like, you look at some of the people, and if people do their due diligence, right? Like, just looking at some of the names that you guys are able to support and the people affiliated with the brand, right? The Hadley Hammers, the Alex Honnolds, everybody that from a variety of different domains, right? And it's like, I think that's the thing, right? If you want to make everybody happy, go sell ice cream. And I don't even think that would work today because people are lactose intolerant. You know,
oh my God, that's so true. That analogy is outdated now. Oh, right. It's terrible.
It's outdated. And that's how funny, but you know what? That's a sign of the times, right? That's an element of like, holy shit. We know when analogies and maxims and things that we kind of thought were timeless are no longer timeless, not just because it's like people don't even know what they want half the time. And they talk themselves into these realities. And you brought up market share, and I just want to touch on this. I remember hearing an interview with Herb Kelleher, who was the co-founder of CEO and CEO of Southwest, right? And mm-hmm. I remember somebody had said to him, they were kind of laughing at what Southwest had done. And they laughed, oh, you don't have a market share and this and that. But they were profitable. And he said, listen, if we have 4% of the market and are profitable, that's better than having 90% of the market and being unprofitable. And it goes hand in hand with, like, you can't change the world if you're on this tight budget all the time and you've got to push, you got to have a quality product and you can't be scared to charge for that because at the end of the day, you stand behind it. And that's the ultimate skin in the game, right? Like being able to say, I stand by this through and through.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you got to get used to hearing no too.
How do you
I think
that
was probably the biggest learning we had in assembling our team and in bringing those individuals into the fold is that if you look at what we feel is a phenomenal group of individuals that stand behind the product and the brand now. For every one of those people, we had 10 people of that caliber say no, or 20. You know, it really, at a very basic level, did not appeal to everyone. And we knew that was going to be the case.
Is that hard for you?
It was. It was. But I don't know. I don't know if you get used to it, or I think more than anything, we've built a vision for this company that we really believe in. And it's not really specific or tied to one product or one person. And so if that product or person or opportunity is no longer available or falls through or blows up even, then, you know, it's just not what defines the company. It's not what defines the opportunity or what we're working on here. So it doesn't really feel like that much of a blow when you've convinced yourself, or I should say rationally convinced yourself, that what you're working on is right and makes sense and is the right thing to be doing.
And you've been doing that for a long time, right? I know I heard a story and I love this story. I laughed out loud. My wife thought I was nuts. You and I probably am going to botch this, but I remember you saying that your grandma had asked you what you wanted to be when you were around 5 years old. And you looked at her and said, venture capitalist. And don't bullshit me, Matt. There's no way you knew what that meant. And you say that in the interview, right? But like when you said you wanted to do this at that age, right? There's a nature and nurture element. Like, how did you even know that word existed? I know you said your dad has a unique background as well. Was this through the things you were exposed to through your father? Or like, how did you even know, why was that word in your lexicon?
Well, first of all, like, I promise I didn't make this story up, right? Like, I obviously don't even remember it. It's just something that's been told to me over and over again. I clearly had no idea what a venture capitalist was, but I knew it was what my dad did, right? And I guess it just ended up being a continued point of interest for me, however many years later.
Do you think that having, and I know the answer can seem obvious here, but humor me, this is for the audience, right? Like, sure. Do you think that having that kind of guidance at a relatively young age is something that kind of calloused your risk tolerance, calloused your ability to hear no, calloused any kind of reticence you may have had to interact with people at a high level or pressure-packed situations? Because I ask this because there's this question constantly, Matt. Somebody asked it a few months ago at a workshop I went to. People are fascinated with this idea, are great leaders, and you can put that contextually however you want, born or made? And the answer is clearly both, but what role did that play consciously or subconsciously in your development, do you think?
I think it played an enormous role. I feel like I'm incredibly lucky that I've been able to, basically have dinner table conversations that, you know, a lot of kids would find boring, but I found incredibly engaging. I used to be able to basically identify different members of boards from companies that my dad was on, because he'd be on calls on speakerphone in the car. This was long before the time of AirPods, of course, but he'd be on speakerphone in the car driving us to, you know, soccer practice or whatever. And so I'd actually learn the different board members' voices. I'd heard them so many times.
Like, so let's reverse engineer this, right? Humor me. Like, Matt, how old are you right now?
21.
Okay. So let's imagine you're a parent someday, or let's just imagine somebody listening to this, right, who doesn't have that upbringing. And they just heard you say how fortunate you were to have these dinner time conversations, right? So a parent says, well, listen, I want to get my kid interested in this shit. So we're going to have some, you know, now all of a sudden this person is trying to sit there and talk to their child about debt financing, convertible debt, disruption, right? Just all these different terms. What I'm getting at here is this: for somebody that didn't have that background, but they want to inculcate these qualities in their son or daughter, how can they possibly hope to get somebody engage like that? Clearly you're abnormal, and I mean that in a great way, but not every kid is going to consider those kinds of conversations fascinating and interesting. So when you're a parent, or for somebody else that's a parent that wants to try to engage your kid in this kind of big picture thinking, how can they create buy-in and how can they get engagement to teach them to think like that?
Well, I think I'm clearly exceptionally unqualified as a parent, but I certainly have had to deal with creating buy-in in employees and investors and people associated with the brand at this point. I think for me personally, when I was young, the folks that my dad was working with, they were rock stars to me. When he talked about them, it was oftentimes in a way that just really connected with me, that these people, particularly when you spoke about, you know, the CEOs of these companies, these were just people that I really looked up to, even for the ones I didn't know personally or have too much interaction with. I really grew up to look up to these people. And so I just had this, I guess, long time desire to find a way to replicate that, right? To find a way to imitate that as much as anything. And that I had folks in my life that were leading by example. And so I think when you try to just force it on someone, it doesn't work. You've got to make it exciting, right? You can't just sit down and talk the kid into it, because that's not what happened for me either. None of this was forced on me, right? It was interesting to me. How could it not be interesting to me? First of all, this is what your dad is doing, right? And if you're seven, then of course you're interested in it. But beyond that, I think the idea of really just trying to create an environment where you can engage with that excitement is really, really valuable. You know, it was always so great to me when I could ask him questions about it, when he would be looking, like the example I gave earlier, right? When he'd be looking at a deck for a company and he'd just ask me what I thought of it, ask me to look at it. When he'd be on the conference call for the first however many minutes of a car ride, and then he's off of it, we talk about it, and I get to ask just simple stuff, right? Like, who was that? What are you guys talking about? Why are you talking about that? Why is that an issue? What is convertible debt?
Right. Yeah.
Right. That's how you learn all those things.
Yeah. And what you're mentioning there, and you brought a hallmark part that I hope the audience is going to listen to, is, like you said, you can't force it on somebody. Those kinds of hard influence tactics generally don't work. And that's kind of what they're referred to in the literature. He won by inclusion, and you won by inclusion as well. He made you a part of a process through these kind of consultation and collaborative tactics of saying, hey, Matt, what do you think of this? Or, hey, come take a look at this. That piques your interest. And as a young man or young woman, you start thinking like, wow, like this is a unique bonding opportunity with dad. And even if it's not something that you know that you're interested in at the time, what you are interested in is bonding with dad. And then those things coincide with one another. And that's an experience that envelops everything that you do within that domain later on. I mean, to give a counterexample, right? Like, I'm not a handy guy, Matt. Like, I could be probably if I focused on it and learned it. I'm a lifelong learner. I love that, whatever. But doing DIY shit I don't enjoy it. And here's part of that reason. One, I'm OCD. If there's a hole in my wall because I messed something up, it's going to drive me nuts. Two, when I was a kid, my dad taught me a lot of great lessons. But one thing he never wanted, I'd try to help him in the garage and he'd be like, get the hell out of here. Cause he knew, I didn't have that attention span for that. I'd end up throwing the hammer somewhere or doing whatever. And that cultivated. Now, on the other hand, my father's pretty similar to your dad in some ways. I don't know your father, so I don't want to be presumptuous. But he would include me on some things, or I remember he would talk to me about his financial upbringing because he grew up dirt poor and had to manage money. But the point is he included you, and there's emotions tied into that. I mean, looking back, do you think that played a part in it? Do you guys still have a collaborative type relationship like that that extends beyond just normal father and son stuff, or where does that lie?
I'll be honest with you. It's really extensive. And sometimes it's actually like it goes the other way, where we'll be like trying to go out for a bike ride or something like that, or just to dinner. And, you know, maybe we haven't seen each other the whole day, or he's been traveling for the week or whatever. And I'll get like 4 or 5 questions in a row about the business. And 99% of the time, right, it's great. And we have this really great dynamic where I feel like I can ask him anything. I always feel like I have somebody that's in my corner. I have somebody whose opinion I can trust that's never going to be dishonest with me. At the same time, you know, sometimes I just want to have dinner.
Sometimes I just want you to be dad.
You come home from a long day and it's like, bam, bam, bam. Did you email these guys? Did you ping these guys? Have you set a time to talk to these guys? Have you sent us a new model yet? Whatever it is.
But like when he asks you those questions, and I understand the dichotomy there, but like, let's focus on when he asks you these questions at first. Like, was there a time where you felt like, holy shit, like dad, like it's not just a respect thing. Like he's not asking me just to make me feel good. Right. It's not like you had a father that didn't just have your hand. He had your back. And when you realize that for the first time, how did that make you feel? Cause so much of that ties into building a great company. It's a feeling, it's a relationship, it's a bonding experience around a common mission. Like, how did that make you feel when you recognized, because not everybody gets that, Matt.
Yeah, I'm sure that's probably true. Other than incredibly fortunate, as I said, I think it made me feel like even stronger that I didn't want to give this anything less than my best.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's probably the most acute junction, I guess, to use the word I used earlier, right? For that, as you mentioned, was that when we started working on the company, however many years ago, I guess this was like 2.5 years ago, we probably had to have this conversation. Mm-hmm. We'd started making some real progress. There was really clearly a substantial idea here, something that we could work behind, but also something that was going to need capital. And he had already been supportive of me, was always willing to talk about my ideas, was always willing to help me look at things or introduce me to folks in his network that I could, you know, also bounce ideas off of. But there basically came this point of inflection where, you know, I don't know if we were in the car or at dinner or where we were, but he basically said, you kind of have a choice here. You can work on this with your resources and have a good experience with it and probably still go to college and have a normal experience there. Or if you want to take this seriously, you're going to need to raise money. And if you're going to need to raise money and you're going to take other people's money and you're going to take my friend's money, then you're going to take it seriously. Because you can't take other people's money and not take this seriously, right? And that was the point of inflection. It's like, you could just go have a good experience with this, have a bit of a, you know, fun time working on a little business, have a, you know, interesting project that you can talk about as experience later on, or you can really go for this thing. But if you're going to go for it, you better not half-ass it. And that was like, that to me was like one of the most exciting moments of my life where it's like, oh, okay. You know, I can go for it. Right. He wouldn't have, because I knew he wouldn't have put it to me like that if he wasn't going to be supportive of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Without
and
a doubt.
So, and it's one thing I think for him to offer his voice or, his ideas and feedback. It's another thing for him to offer, you know, his friends. It's another thing for him to offer a friend's voice, to ask a friend to do a favor, right? And so that felt to me like he placed a lot of trust in me, right?
Without a doubt. I mean, that's it's a lot of trust, not only in what he did for you, it's a lot of trust, to be honest, Matt, in putting himself in a position where he was going to be okay watching you fall or fail. Because it sounds like the time, I mean, that's just the reality, right? Like, cause that's like, if you need, I have a family member in the hospital right now and you know, and it's a situation they got themselves in and it's a situation they're going to get themselves out of. And I think that that's something that people don't embrace enough, is sometimes letting people deal with their own demons, their own failures. And that's, I think this is why this took a unique spin. But something I want to discuss about your father is, you look at these things, right? What individual, what leader, father or otherwise, you know, would tell anybody anything different other than be purpose-driven, commit, nurture an idea, you know, be great, but you're not ever going to be perfect, and learn to, you know, basically love your scars. It sounds like he taught you these in both direct and indirect methods. And that led to a lot of the DNA of what's made Momentous great.
Yeah. I think the love the scars ones was not so explicit, but just learned over time.
Yeah.
He was obviously tremendously supportive. Both my parents were, throughout my whole life, but I specifically remember thinking about playing sports growing up. And I think the only time I ever really felt like, you know, he was disappointed, if you will, or even, you know, sort of felt like I hadn't done as well as I could have was not when I screwed up, not when I didn't play well, not when I didn't do whatever it is the coach said I was supposed to do, not when I didn't show up on time, whatever it was. Do you know what it was? It was when the ref made a call I didn't like and I got upset about it. It was when I missed a shot and I got upset about it. It was when one of my teammates did something dumb and three plays later, I'm clearly still thinking about it. That like bothered him to no end. And now it bothers me to no end.
Yeah.
And that was, I think, the biggest learning for me, frankly, from possibly from my entire sporting experience as a kid, was just learning to deal with those things that you can't control, learning to deal with failures, and really more than anything, just learning to turn the page.
Not always easy, right? And
I was the worst at it. I actually like genuinely considered only doing sports that didn't have referees in them. I was so bad.
We have a lot in common in that respect. When I competed in boxing later in my life, I mean, you're inherently in a, talk about assessing value, right, of a product or a performance. I mean, I'll never forget. I won my first fight by knockout, and there was no subjectivity there. The guy's ass was on the ground. The second fight, it was so annoying how they did U.S. Olympic amateur scoring, because basically you could fight somebody that just pitter-patters you. You barely even feel like you're in a fight. And even if you land bigger blows, they can win the match. And I remember that too. Like, I didn't get in the ring for another 3 months when I lost my second fight by decision because I was so pissed. I felt like, you know, when I hit this guy, I hit the heck out of him. He'd come in and just kind of patty cake me. And this guy won. And I couldn't turn. You would have thought that metaphorical page was made out of lead, the heaviest lead in the world, instead of paper. I couldn't do it. You know, and man, it's interesting. But the past teaches you so much about the future. And that's kind of how I, you know, where do you see, aside from obviously growing and supporting, you know, more and more people around the world, whether it's in the performance space, well, performance is pretty wide ranging, right? But what we traditionally look at as a performance space, let's just call it collegiate, professional, high school sports, tactical, military, business, where do you see Momentous ultimately, you know, going in the future if you have your way? What do you see it extending its branches into and being able to serve?
I think the really short answer is more people. And so really it becomes a question of how do you serve more people? How do you convince more people to train smarter, to eat smarter, to really pursue the best versions of themselves? And how do you support that vision? And when I think about what the next phase of Momentous looks like, there's a pretty obvious component, which is, you know, the next 20-some products, right? There are however many categories in performance nutrition and vitamin supplements and in functional foods that we feel we can create a best-in-class product in, that we feel we can create a product that serves the needs of professional and aspiring athletes better than anyone. That's the obvious thing. But when I think about what the next phase is for Momentous, I think we need to be really looking to serve the needs of those individuals that can't be put in a bottle. How do we capture the things, the methods, the mindsets of elite performers that can help so many people around the world that the vast majority of individuals just don't have access to? How do we share those things that, like I said, cannot be put in a bottle?
That is probably the reason you just touched on right there, Matt, that And I'll be honest, and I don't think I've ever disclosed this to a member of your team. I don't think I've disclosed it to a member of my team or the audience. When we were talking about finding reasons to say no, when we had first started having the discussions we had and about the unique partnership we have today, I looked for a lot of reasons to say no to you guys. And I'm sure you did this. I'm sure you did the same for me, but here was why, right? Like, because, and you mentioned it early on, like we're inundated with messaging and companies that claim to do this and that. And like, let me be clear, everybody, when you look at what people say about Momentous, I mean, they've been voted the number one whey protein by Men's Journal. Like they're called the Ferrari of supplements, even Muscle and Fitness. So it's funny, right? Cause you talked about like how you guys have to compete against quote unquote bodybuilding supplements. Even they called you the cleanest grass-fed whey protein on the market. But ultimately, like what I thought about is like, yeah, that stuff will get there. And I'm sure you guys have a great product, but I'm just at a point in my life, Matt, being 33 and like really going on 78, because I've been through some unique shit, where I just needed to be around people who were sui generis, who were honest, who wanted to kind of just like keep their head in their clouds, but their hands at the grindstone. And that's ultimately, man, what made you guys stand out for me. And it's been a decision I've never regretted, man. And, you know, I'm so appreciative of that, because you do have a really unique team. You do have a really unique vision, and all of that is representative of your leadership and all the lessons and things that you've shared within this podcast.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you sharing that, Brett. That obviously means a lot. And I guess likewise on our side, why or part of why we were excited to be supportive of content like this is that it's the things that can't be bottled, right? That we thought it is actually our place to support getting your voice out there more, to support getting the voice out of the other people who are on the show. You know, I'm clearly not the most interesting one that's going to be on here this month. I know you've got a ridiculously long queue of just insanely interesting people to share stories from, but that was really just so perfectly in line with how we thought about our opportunity to bring value to this market, is to support the right voices.
Well, and this is just the beginning of it, man. So, you know, I appreciate you. And guys, I want to make sure, again, if you're listening to this, you've heard me talk about them a lot. Let me be very clear. Momentous and people like Matt and his team are the reason I'm able to bring you this podcast every single week. This is the stuff behind the scenes. Like he said, it's the things that can't be bottled. And ultimately that to me is what I think, you know, when people reach out and they say, hey, how can I separate myself? How can I do this? It's capture the things that can't be bottled. It's appreciate the things that have a unique a cost, but more importantly, a unique effect on the individuals around you. And so make sure you guys support them. Make sure you go to livemomentous.com. Make sure you're reading the show notes. Make sure you're doing the research about what you are putting in your bodies. Everybody in my family nearly has died of heart disease and or cancer. To me, it's a no-brainer. My diet is not perfect, but the things that I use to supplement that diet and the things that I try to build my lifestyle around are all the things that Momentous embodies. So understand the importance here. Matt, is there anything I missed? Any final thoughts you want to leave them with, man?
I think you nailed it. I think you nailed it, Brett. I think that's why you're one of our customers. I think it's why you're, you know, so clearly, precisely part of our core audience, is that it doesn't matter if you're not eating perfectly. It doesn't matter if you're training perfectly. We can work on those things. We can help you with those things, right? What we can't spend time on, and what we can't convince you of is that you should be eating well, that you should be training well, that you should be taking care of yourself. If you're not there already, then that's a real challenge.
Yeah, without a doubt. Well, thanks again, Matt, for your time. I know you have a lot of things pulling at you and you have a lot of things going on. So for you to take the time means a lot. And guys, as always, make sure to support the show, support Momentous, share this episode with a friend, and make sure to leave a review and a rating on iTunes. We appreciate all your support. And Matt, thanks once again.
Thanks so much, Brett.
Listen, one more thing before you go, and I know a lot has been crammed into this episode, but I want to make sure I let you know about my YouTube channel. So I didn't do anything on YouTube for the longest time, but per your guys' requests and per some folks that just really wanted some more visual content, whether that be just tips, advice, strategies, or even visuals of the type of coaching that I do, live events and workshops, I have created a YouTube channel that showcases even more in-depth information that complements the podcast, the book, and everything we're doing at Art of Coaching. So if you found value in this resource or you're enjoying the content, please make sure you visit my YouTube channel, subscribe, and we're going to continue to try to put out a wide variety of things that whether you're a coach, whether you're a personal trainer, whether you're a CEO, whether you're a manager, all in some way, shape, or form help you better interact with people and figure out how to work on bridging the gaps in your own development. So again, check out the YouTube channel, check out anything else that we do at artofcoaching.com, and thanks again for tuning into the show. I appreciate each and every one of you.